Thank you, God. How could I leave my baby girl?
Diana reached over from where she was sitting on the edge of the other bed and put her hand lightly on Liddy's arm.
I'm grateful you were spared, Liddy, she said softly.
Liddy pressed her lips together and gave a little nod.
I reckon I'm too ornery to die.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Can you remember just what Mr. Marston said when he asked about me?
He didn't speak directly to me. He doesn't like to think that you and I are friends, you know. But I know he was worried. He wouldn't want to lose you.
So, I still got a place?
Diana looked at her as though she were crazy. Why on earth not?
I stomped his foot.
You what?
I was all a fever, only I didn't know it, eh? And he tried to hold me after the rest had gone. He wouldn't let me go, so I stomped down on his foot.
Diana threw her head back and laughed out loud. No, no, she said, trying to recover. No, she said, taking out her handkerchief and wiping her eyes. He's probably more frightened than you are. Have you ever seen Mrs. Overseer Marsden, Liddy? If word ever got to that august lady. She stopped laughing and lowered her voice, her ear cocked toward the open door. Nevertheless, I wouldn't make attacking the overseer a regular practice, my dear. Do be more discreet in the future. That is, if you want to stay on at the corporation. The day may come when Mr. Marsden would welcome any excuse to let you go. She smiled wryly. It sounds as though I'm advising you not to sign any petitions or consort with any known radicals.
But maybe he meant nothing. I was burnt up with the fever. Maybe I mistook kindness for...
She grimaced.
You know, I'm not the kind of girl men look at that way. I'm plain as plowed sod.
Diana raised an eyebrow, but Rachel and Bridget were at the door with the tea, so she said nothing more.
I'll pretend,
thought Liddy, as she tried to unsnarl her brain over the steaming cup.
I'll pretend I was crazy from the fever and didn't know what I was doing. Can't even remember what I did. I want to be a doffer, Liddy,
Rachel said. Liddy had brushed her sister's curls and was weaving them into plaits. Rachel wanted to pin her hair up like the big girls in the house, but Liddy insisted that the braids hang down. She couldn't bear for Rachel to look like a funny little make-believe woman.
Bridget says her little sister is a doffer and she's no bigger than me.
Oh, Rachel, you need to go to school.
She loved to braid Rachel's hair, but was suddenly ashamed that she had only string to bind it with. She should have splurged on a bit of ribbon. Rachel was so pretty for all her being too thin. She ought to have bright bows to set off the two silky curls at the end of each plait. They would brighten her drab little dress. But ribbons cost money, and string bound the hair just as well. She twisted each curl around her index finger and gave it a final brush.
We got to get you into school. You don't want to grow ignorant as your Liddy.
You ain't ignorant at all. I seed you read.
You want I should read to you, Rachie?
No, I want you should let me be a doffer.
We'll have to wait and see, eh? When we hear from Charlie.
But they didn't hear from Charlie. They heard from Quaker Stevens.
Dear Sister Worthen, thy brother asked me to look into the sale of thy farm. All inquiry has come to naught, but as I have business in thy uncle's neighborhood on Wednesday next, I will inquire directly at that time. I trust thee and the little one are in good health. Son Luke asks to be remembered to thee. Thy friend and neighbor, Jeremiah Stevens.
She tried not to feel angry at Charlie for not writing to her himself. He had, after all, done the sensible thing. To the law and their uncle, they were only children. Judah would have to listen to Quaker Stevens. He was a man of substance. She was glad to know that Luke had gotten safely home. She had finally realized that the freight he had come to fetch was human. The letter meant, though, that she could wait no longer. Something would have to be done about Rachel. The promised fortnight had passed, and she must go back to work herself on the morrow. She sent Rachel to the bedroom, stuffed the letter in her apron pocket, and went into the kitchen. She didn't start with the request, but with an offer of help to fix dinner. Mrs. Bedloe was always grateful for an extra hand in the kitchen, even though the house was now down to only 20 girls.
"You give me more than the fortnight, Mrs. Bedloe, and I am obliged," she said, once the cabbage had been chopped and the bread sliced.
"You are near to death, Liddy. I'm not without heart."
"Indeed not."
Liddy smiled as warmly as she knew how.
"You've been more'n good to me and mine, which is why I dare."
"It won't do, you know. I can't keep her on indefinitely."
"But if she was a doffer?"
"She's hardly more than a baby."
"She's small, but she's a worker. Didn't she nurse me, eh?"
"She pulled you through. I wouldn't have warranted it."
"Could you ask the agent for me, just until I got things set with my brother? All I want to do is take her home. It wouldn't be for long, I swear. Meantime, I've not the heart to set her out with strangers."
Mrs. Bedloe was weakening. Liddy could read it in the sag of her face. She pressed on eagerly.
"It won't be more than a few weeks, and I'd pay extra, I would. I know it's hard for you with only 20 girls here regular."
"I'll speak to the agent, but I can't promise you."
I know, but if you'll just ask for me, she's a fine little worker and so eager to make good."
"I can't promise anything."
"Would you go now and ask?"
"Now? I'm in the middle of fixing dinner."
"I'll finish for you, please, so I can take her over when I go back to work tomorrow."
It was arranged. Liddy suspected that Mrs. Bedloe had added a few years and several pounds in her description of Rachel to the agent, but a skeptical look was all she got from the overseer on the spinning floor when she presented Rachel for work the next morning. And Rachel looked so bright and eager and smiled so sweetly that even the skeptical look melted. And she was sent skipping down the aisle to meet the other doffers under the care of a kindly middle-aged spinner. Slowly, Liddy climbed the flight of stairs to the weaving room. Her worry for Rachel had pushed aside, for a time, her own fears of seeing Mr. Marsden again. She didn't dare look in his direction, but went straight to her looms where Bridget was already at work, cleaning and oiling.
"You're looking much the rosier," Bridget said.
How pretty the girl was with her light brown hair and eyes clear blue as a bright February sky after snow. It was the smile, though, that transformed her into a real beauty. Liddy smiled back. She did not envy other women their good looks, and even if she had been so inclined, she would never begrudge this bounty of nature to one so poor in everything else.
"We covered the machines as best we could while you were gone, me and Diana. Though,"
she smiled apologetically, "you'll see from your wage the work was not near what it would be had you been here." It was all they had time to say before Mr. Marsden stepped on his stool and pulled the cord that set the room to roaring and shaking. Liddy jumped, then laughed. How quickly she'd forgotten the noise. Within minutes she had settled in and forgotten everything else. Mr. Marsden, her weakness, the farm, Charlie, even Rachel. It was good to be back with her beasts again. She belonged among them, somehow. By the breakfast bell she was almost too tired to eat. She would, if she could have chosen, sat out the break in the window alcove, but that would leave her alone on the floor. She glanced at Mr. Marsden and hurried toward the stairs. He didn't speak to her. It was as if nothing had occurred between them, except that he never came over to her loom to pat and encourage her. Not once. She managed to eat breakfast, or some of it. Rachel was stuffing herself like a regular factory girl, talking excitedly at the same time. She stopped only to look at Liddy and say through her full mouth,
"Eat, Liddy. You got to eat and grow strong."
So it was she got through breakfast and dinner, but by supper she could only manage a few bites of stew before she dragged herself up to bed. Fatigue was like a toothache in her bones. She would have cursed her weakness, had she the strength. Each day, though, she was a little stronger. At first she could not feel it, no more than a body can feel itself grow taller. But by the end of the week, she found that she had eaten a full plate at supper and was lingering in the parlor with Rachel, who was watching, fascinated, as a phrenologist sought to sell his services to the girls.
"Please, Liddy,"
Rachel begged,
"let's have our heads done."
"I know about my head, Rachel. Why should I pay good money to find out it's plain as sod and stubborn as a mule?
And such a skinflint, a penny would freeze to your fist before you'd spend it," the phrenologist snapped. "I give you that reading for free. Not that there's hope you'd pay."
The other girls in the parlor tittered. Even Liddy tried to smile, but Rachel was indignant.
"She's not mean. She's going to buy me ribbons," she declared. "Come on, Liddy," she added, taking her hand. "Let's go read the book you bought me."
The girls laughed again, but more gently. They had never cared much for Liddy, whom they knew to be close with her money and her friendships. But Rachel was rapidly becoming their pet. How dry her life had been before Rachel came. It was like springs of water in the desert to have her here. She kissed her head that night before she tucked her in.
"You don't think your Liddy is a cheap old spinster, eh?"
Rachel was furious all over again.
"You're the best sister in the world."
Liddy blew out the candle. She lay listening to Rachel's even breathing and heard in her memory the sounds of birds in the spring woods. If only she could hear from Charlie, Liddy's happiness would be complete. The money was growing again. She had nearly caught up with the wages lost by her illness. And even though Rachel made only a pittance, it paid her room and board. She had seldom been happier. She woke in the night, puzzled. She thought she had heard Betsy again, that wretched hacking sound that sawed through her ribcage straight into her heart. And then she was wide awake and knew it to be Rachel. It was only a cold. Surely it was nothing. She would be over it in a week. See, the child seemed bright-eyed and lively as ever. If she were sick, really sick. Liddy kept the knowledge of the night cough tight inside herself, but the fear grew like a tumor. She began to lie awake, listening for the awful sound, until finally she knew she must send the child away. Anywhere, just so she was not breathing this poison air.
"It will break my heart to send the child away." Liddy could not bear the thought. "It might break Rachel's heart as well. She's been sent away too often in her short life. Look, she dotes on me. Me, tough and mean as I be. She clings to me more than she ever did our mother. She needs me." Liddy did not know what to do, and she was too terrified to ask. No one must know. She fed Rachel the pills Bridget had brought her. She had no faith in them, but she must try. She fixed plasters for the child's chest, trying to turn it into a game, desperate to hide her own terror. And she was succeeding, wasn't she? Rachel seemed happy as ever and carefree as a kitten. Caught in a spasm of coughing, she made light of it.
Silly cough, she said.
All the girls have them. Liddy mustn't worry. Summer was here. The weather was warm. Rachel would be over it soon. They'd take July off, go back to the farm, the two of them. But it was a vain dream, Liddy knew. There would be nothing to eat there. The cow was gone, and no crops planted. Tryphena. She would send Rachel to Tryphena. But Tryphena meant Mistress Cutler, as well as that lonely, airless attic. How could she do to Rachel at 8 what her mother had done to her at 13? It had been hard even then, and so very lonely. She hadn't realized how lonely until now, now that she was no longer alone. Then, one evening in late June, she had just read Rachel to sleep, Tim knocked on the door.
"A visitor for you, Liddy," he said, "in the parlor."
Chapter 18. Charlie at Last. She hardly knew him. He was not so much taller, but bigger somehow, foreign. He wore homespun, but it was well tailored to his body. His brown hair was combed neatly against his head, and a carpet bag hung from his right hand.
"Sister,"
he said quietly, and the voice was one she had never heard before and would not have known for his.
"Sister,"
he repeated, his voice cracking on the words.
"It's me, Charles."
"Yes," she said,
"Charles, so you've come."
He smiled then. She looked in vain for the funny, serious little boy she knew. He wasn't 13 yet. How could he have discarded that little child so quickly? He glanced around the crowded room. All the staring faces quickly dived back into their sewing or knitting or conversation.
"I took the railroad car,"
he said in quiet pride.
"The stage into New Hampshire, to Concord, and then all the rest of the way by train."
Then he grinned like a child, but not the child she remembered. Not quite. She didn't know what to say. She cared nothing for railroads, those dangerous, dirty things. It was the farm she ached to know about.
"Well," she said at last, "you must be tired, eh?"
She cast about the parlor for two free chairs. At her glance, three girls rose and abandoned theirs in the far corner of the room beyond the dining tables. She thanked them and led him over. It was she who felt the need to sit.
"Well,"
she said, arranging her apron on her lap,
"well, then?"
It was as much of a question as she could manage.
"I got good news, Liddy,"
he said, a little of the boy she knew creeping into his voice. Her heart rose.
"The Finneys have taken me on as full apprentice."
"Eh?"
"More than that, truly. They treat me like their own. They don't have no child but me."
"You got a family?"
she said faintly.
"You'll always be my sister, Liddy. I don't forget that. It's just..."
He put the carpet bag on the floor and laid his cap carefully on top. His hands were big now, too large for his body. Finally, he looked up at her.
"It's just, I don't have to worry every morning when I get up and every night when I lie abed. I just do my work, and every day, three times, the food is there. When the work is slack, I go to school. It's a good life they give me, Liddy."
She wanted to scream out at him, remind him how hard she had worked for him, how hard she had tried. But she only said softly,
"I wanted to do for you, Charlie. I tried."
"Oh, Liddy, I know,"
he said, leaning toward her.
"I know. But it weren't fair to you, you only a girl, trying to be father and mother and sister to us all. It were too much. This'll be best for you, too, eh? Don't you see? No!
She wanted to howl.
No! What will be the use of me, then?
But she kept her lips pressed together against such a cry. At last she said,
"There's Rachel."
He smiled again, his grown-up smile that turned him into a stranger.
I have good news there, too. Mrs. Finney asked me to bring Rachel back. She craves a daughter as well, and she'll be so good to her, you'll see. She even sent a dress. She made it herself for Rachel to wear on the train, with a bonnet even.
His eyes went to the carpet bag beside the chair. She's never had a proper ma, Rachel.
She has me. Oh, Charlie, I ain't perfect, but I do my best, can't you see? I done my best for you. She's all I got left now. How can I let her go?
But even as she stormed within herself, she knew she had no choice. Like the rusty blade through her heart, she felt it.
If she stays here with me, she will die. If I cling to her, I will be her death.
She heard her own voice, calm as morning after a storm, no, quiet as death, say,
"When will you be leaving?"
"The train leaves Lowell at 7:05 of the morning. I'll come to fetch her at 6:30.
I'll have her ready before I go to work."
She stood. There was nothing more to be said. He stood, too, cap in hand, wanting, she knew, to say more, but not knowing quite how. She waited.
"About the farm,"
he began. The farm. A few minutes before she had thought it was all she cared about. Now it had ceased to matter.
"Uncle Judah's bound and determined to sell."
Liddy nodded.
"Well,"
she said,
"so be it."
He grinned wryly.
"For a man who says the Lord is set to end the whole creation at any minute, he's got a powerful concern for the vain things of this world."
She realized he was trying to be funny, so she attempted a smile.
"But I near forgot."
He reached into an inside pocket and took out a sealed letter. Liddy stared at it.
"He ain't sending me money."
"Who?"
"Uncle."
"Oh, no, not him. He says anything from the sale is rightly his for taking care of Ma and the babies all this time. No, this here's a letter."
He handed it to her, studying her face the while.
"From Luke."
"Luke who?"
"Liddy, our friend Luke, our neighbor, Luke Stevens."
He seemed shocked. He couldn't know she was 2 lifetimes away from the day Luke had driven them to the village and at least 1 lifetime from the day the Quaker boy had stood on the doorstep of No. 5 in his peculiar disguise. She tucked the letter in her apron pocket.
"Thank you,"
she said.
"And goodbye, I reckon. I'll not be here in the morning when you come."
"It'll be all right, Liddy. It'll be best for us all, eh?"
His voice was anxious.
"It'll work out best for you as well."
"You forgot your bag,"
she said.
"No, that's for Rachel."
He picked it up and handed it to her. He put out his hand as if to shake hers, but hers were tightly wrapped around the handle of the bag. She nodded instead. The next she saw him, he would be taller than she, Liddy thought. If there was a next time. She led him to the door.
"Goodbye,"
she mouthed the words. She couldn't have spoken them aloud if she dared. She climbed the stairs like an old, decrepit woman, clinging to the banister and pulling herself up step by step. Rachel was fast asleep. she would not wake her. In the candlelight, she studied the lovely little face, too thin, too pale, the skin nearly transparent. Liddy brushed back a curl that had escaped its plait and smoothed it against Rachel's cheek. Any minute she would start to cough, her little body racked, the bed shaking. Mrs. Finney would keep her safe. She could go to school. She could have a good life. A real mother. And she will forget me, plain, rough, miserly Liddy, who only bought her ribbons because she was shamed to it. Will she ever know how much I loved her? How I would have gladly laid down my life and died for her? How, O Lord, I am dying this very minute for her. She took out the dress. It was a lovely sprigged muslin. It looked too big for Rachel's tiny frame, but the child would grow into it. She would lengthen and fatten and turn once again into a stranger. Liddy's tears were soaking the dress. She wiped her face on her own apron skirt, then laid out the new garments, the frilly little bonnet with ribbons and lace, a petticoat fit for a wedding. A length of pink ribbon was woven in and out all around the top of the hem, wasted, pure waste, where no one would ever see it, except Rachel. She packed the bag. It took less than a minute. Rachel had so little. She remembered the primer and then decided to keep it. Rachel would have a new one, a better one now. She took the book of verses off the nightstand and shut it in the bag, then took it out again. She got her box of writing materials, dipped her pen in the ink, and wrote in painful, careful script on the flyleaf,
"For Rachel Worthen, from her sister Lydia Worthen, June 24, 1846.
Wiping her face carefully on her apron as she wrote, so as not to blot the page. She lay awake most of the night, listening to Rachel cough, the sound rasping and sawing through her own body. But the pain of it was her salvation. She knew, if she had ever doubted before, she was absolutely certain that Rachel must leave Lowell. When the first bell rang, instead of waking Rachel as usual, she waited until she herself was dressed and ready to go. Then she shook her gently. Rachel awoke at once, alarmed.
"I'm late. Why did you let me sleep?"
"You got a treat today, Rachel. Charlie's come to fetch you."
"Charlie? My brother Charlie?"
She was as excited as if she could really remember him. Liddy brushed away a cobweb of envy.
"He's come to take you for a visit."
"He wants me to visit him?"
She was plainly thrilled, but then she caught something in Liddy's face.
"You coming too, ain't you, Liddy?"
"No, not me. I got to work, eh?"
The child's face darkened.
"I'll come later."
She stretched out her hand. "Here, up you go. You got to get ready." Rachel took Liddy's hand and pulled herself upright, then threw back the covers. The child always slept under a quilt, even in the terrible summer heat.
"How long will I be gone, Liddy?"
"I don't rightly know. We both, me and Charlie, we both think you should stay a while. Make sure you get rid of that silly coffee. The factory is too hot in summer anyways. Lots of the girls take off come July."
"Will you take off, Liddy?"
She was standing in her little night shift, scratching one leg with the bare toes of the other.
"I just might. Who knows, eh?"
Liddy wrung out the cloth over the basin and handed it to Rachel to wash.
"Come with me now, Liddy."
"On the other bed is a new dress for you to put on. You got to dress fancy for riding on a train."
"A railroad train?"
"Luckiest girl I know.
new dress and bonnet, train ride, holiday with a handsome man." She took the cloth from Rachel's hand, tipped up the child's chin, and began to wash her upturned face. "Now you learn your letters better so you can write me all about that train ride." The bell began to ring. She turned swiftly, wringing the cloth out over the basin, her face to the wall, lest she betray herself.
"He'll be here to fetch you in an hour or so," she said brightly. "So get yourself dressed and go down and ask Mrs. Bedlow to give you an extra big breakfast."
She turned only long enough to give Rachel a light kiss on the cheek and then hurried out the door.
"Come soon, Liddy,"
Rachel's voice followed her down the stairs.
"I'll miss you."
"Be a good girl for Charlie,"
she called back, and rushed on down the stairs with a great clatter to erase any more sounds, any more doubts. Rachel had been gone nearly a week when she found the letter with her name written on it in small, neat handwriting. She had stuffed it into her trunk some days before and couldn't remember at first where it had come from. She unsealed it curiously.
"Dear Liddy Worthen, doubtless thy Charlie has told thee about thy farm. Although our father pled on thy behalf, thy uncle could not be moved. Thus our father put down the purchase price himself, as he has four sons and not enough land for us all. I have spoken with thy Charlie. He has urged me to put aside my fears and speak my heart plain, which is that I long to earn from our father the deed to thy farm, yet thy land would be barren without thee. May I dare ask thee to return, not as sister, but as wife? Forgive these bold words, but I know not how to fashion pretty phrases fit for such as thee. In all respect, thy friend, Luke Stevens."
What had Charlie said to the man to make him dare write such a letter? "Do they think they can buy me? Do they think I will sell myself for that land? That land I have no one to take to anymore? I have nothing left but me, Liddy Worthen. Do they think I will sell her? I will not be a slave, nor will I be his freight, some homeless fugitive that Luke Stevens must bend down his lofty Quaker soul to rescue." She tore the letter into tiny bits and stuffed every shred of it into Mrs. Bedlow's iron cook stove, and then, to her own amazement, burst into tears. Chapter 19. Diana. She had been alone before Rachel came, but she had not known what loneliness was. This sharp pain in her breastbone, dragging down into a dull, persistent heaviness. "My heart is heavy," she thought. "It's not just a saying. It is what is heavy. A great stone lodged in my breast, pressing down my whole being. How can I even stand straight and look out upon the world? I am doubled over into myself, and, for all the weight, find only emptiness." Workdays dragged by with nothing to look forward to at the evening bell. Rumor had it that the corporation had slowed the clocks to squeeze even more minutes out of the long summer shift. From time to time, she wondered why she was working so hard now that the farm was sold and Rachel and Charlie lost to her. She brushed the question aside. She worked hard because work was all she knew, all she had. Everything else that had made her know herself as Liddy Worthen was gone. Nothing but hard work, so hard that her mind became as calloused as her hands. Work alone remained. She fell into bed exhausted and only felt the full burden of her grief in dreams, which, determined as she was, she could not control. The weavers at the Massachusetts Corporation had all refused the agent's demand that they each tend 4 looms and take a piece rate reduction as well. They signed a pledge in defiance, and none of them backed down. The word went like a whispered wave through the Concord weaving room.
Not a girl has backed down, not a one.
Diana should have been elated. Wasn't it a victory for the association? But when Liddy was finally able to rouse herself from her own pain, she saw that Diana's face was drawn, the expression grim and set. Since Rachel was gone, whenever Bridget or Diana had tried to reach out to her, she had shaken them off. No one could understand her loss, she was sure. She did not have the strength to bear their vain attempts to comfort. Then, suddenly, it was mid-July, and Liddy realized that Diana was still at work, looking more sickly by the day. It was more than the heat of the weaving room.
She's worried, Liddy thought. She's sore troubled, and I, so bent on my own trial, never took it to mind.
Liddy tried to speak to Diana on the stairs, but she seemed hardly to hear the greeting.
Are they threatening her with dismissal? With blacklisting?
A chill went through Liddy. She thought she had nothing else to lose, but suppose Diana was to go. Diana, the one person who, from her first day on, had treated her like a proper person. The only one who had never laughed at Liddy's queer mountain speech or demanded that she change her manners or her mind. All the girls took their burdens to Diana. She was always the one who came to help you. Nobody ever thought of Diana needing help.
She's ill, like Betsy and Rachel and Prudence and a host of others, Liddy thought. She's worked here too long and too hard. How much longer could Diana last? How much longer could any of them last? I must do something for her, Liddy decided. Give her a present.
There was only one present, good enough. Diana! Liddy worked her way through the jostling crowd of operatives crossing the yard.
I been thinking.
She glanced around to see if anyone was listening, but all the girls were too intent on rushing home for their suppers.
About the...
Even now that she had made up her mind, she couldn't quite bring herself to speak the forbidden word in the very courtyard of the corporation. She took a deep breath.
I been thinking on signing.
The older girl turned to her and put her hand on Liddy's sleeve. Well, she said, and Liddy couldn't quite make out the rest in the clamor of the yard, but it sounded something like, well, we'll see, as Diana let herself be carried away in the rushing stream of operatives.
But I mean it, thought Liddy. I mean it.
Earlier in the spring, she had known that there were girls in her own house secretly circulating the petition, but now that she had made up her mind to it, she wanted to do it for Diana. How could it be a true present otherwise? After supper, she put on her bonnet and went to Diana's boarding house. She asked one of the girls in the front room of number 3 for Diana. Diana Goss? The girl asked with a sneer. It's Tuesday. She'll be at her meeting.
Oh.
The girl looked her up and down as though memorizing her features. Maybe the girl was a corporation spy.
Stare her down, Liddy told herself.
The other was shorter than she, so when Liddy stood tall and looked down into her eyes, the girl shifted her gaze. It's at their reading room, on Central Street. She glanced back at Liddy. The sneer had returned. Number 76. All are welcome, so I'm told. In for a penny, in for a pound, thought Liddy, and made her way into town. The meeting had already begun. Someone was reading minutes. The 40 or so girls crowded into the small room looked almost like a sewing circle, so many of the girls were doing mending or needlework. Hello, the young woman who seemed to be in charge interrupted the secretary's droning. Come on in. Liddy stepped into the room, looking about uncertainly for a chair. To her relief, she saw Diana getting up and coming toward her. You came, she said, her tired features relaxing into a smile. It reminded her of that first night when she had gone to see Diana, except then Diana had looked lovely and full of life. She took Liddy to a place where there were two vacant chairs and sat beside her while the meeting carried on. It was hard for Liddy to follow the discussion. They were planning something for some sort of rally at the end of the month. She kept waiting for someone to mention the petition so she could declare herself ready to sign, but no one did. At the first curfew bell, the woman in charge pronounced the meeting adjourned until the following Tuesday, and the girls broke into a buzz, gathering their sewing things together and putting on bonnets to leave. The woman who had been in charge came over to where Liddy was standing with Diana. She stretched out her hand. I'm Mary Emerson, she said. Welcome. I think this is your first time with us? Liddy shook the woman's hand and nodded. This is my friend, Lydia Worthen, Diana said. She's thinking about joining us. Miss Emerson turned expectantly to Liddy. I come to sign the petition, Liddy said. The woman cocked her head, seemingly puzzled. What was the matter with her?
The one to ask for 10-hour work days.
Why was she explaining the petition to a leader of the movement? It was crazy. Maybe next year, Diana was saying quietly.
No, I made up my mind to do it. I want to do it now, tonight.
But we've already submitted it, Miss Emerson said. We had to before the legislature recessed for the year. She had at long last made up her mind to do it, and now it was too late?
But
next year, Diana repeated, you can put your name in the very first column if you like. Yes, said Miss Emerson brightly. That's our motto. We'll try again. Since 4,000 names didn't convince them, next year we'll have to get 8. She gave Liddy the kind of encouraging smile a teacher gives to a slow pupil. We'll need all the help we can get. Liddy stood there, open-mouthed, looking from Diana's thin face to the other woman's robust one. Too late. She'd come too late. She was always too late. Too late to save the farm. Too late to keep her family together. Too late to do for Diana the only thing she knew to do. We'd better get you back to number 5, Diana was saying, like she was some helpless child who needed tending. You wouldn't want to be late. They hurried down the dimly lit streets toward the Concord boarding houses without speaking. Liddy wanted to explain, to say she was sorry, to somehow make it up to Diana, but she didn't know how to do it. As they neared number 5, Diana broke the silence. Thank you for coming tonight.
Oh, Diana, I come too late.
You came as soon as you could.
I'm always too late to do any good.
Liddy. Diana was hesitating. I'll miss you. What was she saying?
I ain't going nowhere. I'll be right here, next year and the next.
No. I'm the one who'll be leaving.
But where would you be going?
Diana had always said that the mill was her family. Boston, I think.
I don't understand.
Are you ailing?
Liddy, if I don't leave soon, right away, in fact, I'll be dismissed.
It's because of the cussed petition. They're trying to get you.
No, not that. I wish it were. They had stopped walking and stood several yards away from the steps of number 5. They both watched the heavy door swing open and glimpsed the light inside as 2 girls hurried in to beat the final bell. It's because... Oh, Liddy, don't despise me.
I could never do that.
How could Diana say such a thing? Liddy, I've been... Oh, I don't know. Foolish? Wicked?
What are you talking about? You could never be...
Oh, yes. She was silent for a moment, as though sifting the words she needed from the chaff of her thoughts. I'm going to have a child, Liddy.
A what?
Her voice had dropped to a stunned whisper. She tried to search Diana's features, but it was too dark to read her expression.
Who done this to you?
She asked finally. Oh, Liddy, no one done it to me.
Then he'll marry you, eh?
He's not free to marry. There's a wife in Concord. She wouldn't come to live here in a factory town, though her father is one of the owners. Diana's laugh was short and harsh. It was that doctor. Liddy was sure of it. He looked so kind and gentle, and all the time...
But what will you do?
She could hear now the shrillness in her voice. She tried to tone it down.
Where can you go?
I've got some savings, and he's determined to help as he can. I'll find work. We'll manage, the baby and I.
It ain't right.
I'll need to go soon. I can't bring dishonor on the association. Any whisper of this, and our enemies will dance like dervishes with delight. She could hear the grim amusement in Diana's voice. I won't hand them a weapon to destroy us. Not if I can possibly help it.
How can I help you? Oh, Diana, I've been so blind.
She touched Liddy's cheek lightly. Let's just pray everyone has been as blind. I'll write you, if I may, tell you how things go.
You've been so good to me.
I'll miss you, little Liddy. The final bell began to clang. Quick, slip in before they lock you out.
Diana.
But the older girl pushed her toward the door and hurried away down the street toward number 3. The word passed around the floor next morning was that Diana Goss had left, snatching an honorable dismissal while she could still get it. Much more of her radical doings, and she would have been blacklisted. Or so the rumors went. Chapter 20. B is for Bridget. Bridget had 2 looms now and would soon be ready for a 3rd. She stood between them proudly, the sweat pouring from her forehead in concentration. If she would wear less clothing, but no, the girls from the acre wore the same layers of dress summer and winter. Still, despite her craziness, Bridget was turning into a proper operative. Mr. Marsden hardly came past Liddy's looms these days. When their eyes met by chance, it was as though they had never been introduced. Earlier, his coldness had worried her. She feared then that he might find some reason to dismiss her, so she had been scrupulous to observe every regulation to the letter. As the days went on, she became less anxious about Mr. Marsden's state of mind, much preferring his coolness to the rosebud smiles and little pats she had endured before her illness. she treated herself to some more books. In honor of Ezekiel Freeman, what a handsome name her friend had chosen for himself, she bought Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, written by himself, and a Bible. Both volumes became a quiet comfort to her Sunday loneliness, because as she read them, she could hear Ezekiel's rich, warm voice filling the darkness of the cabin. She had liked Mr. Dickens' account of his travels in America, all but the Lowell part. It was, as Diana had warned her, romantical. There was no mention, in its rosy descriptions, of sick lungs or blacklisting or men with wives at Concord. July wore on its weary way into August. It seemed a century since the summer just a year ago when she had read and reread Oliver Twist and dreamed of home. She had been such a child then, such a foolish, unknowing child. As always, many of the New England operatives had gone home. Bridget took on her third loom. More Irish girls came on as spare hands. Some of the machines simply stood idle. The room was quieter. Liddy took to copying out passages from Mr. Douglass and the Bible to paste on her looms. She liked the Psalms best. "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills," and "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion." The Psalms were poetry, no, songs that rode the powerful rhythm of the looms. Sometimes she composed her own. "By the rivers of Merrimack and Concord, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered." "I must forget," she thought. "I must forget them all. I cannot bear the remembering." Liddy was strong again. Her body no longer betrayed her into exhaustion by the end of the day, and she was past shedding tears for what might have been. It was a relief, she told herself, not to carry the burden of debt, or, what was worse, the welfare of other persons. A great yoke had been lifted from her shoulders, had it not? And some day the stone would be taken from her breast as well. Between them, she and Bridget coached several of the new spare hands, all of them wearing far too much clothing in the suffocating heat.
"But me mither says me keeps will keep me cool,"
one of the girls insisted. Liddy let it be. She hadn't managed to persuade Bridget to take off her silly capes. How could she expect to persuade the new girls? Still, she was more patient with them than she had ever been with poor Bridget at the beginning. She had to be. Bridget herself was a paragon of gentleness, teaching the new girls all that Liddy and Diana had taught her, never raising her voice in irritation or complaint. Liddy watched her snip off a length of thread from a bobbin and lead on one of the clumsier girls over to the window and show her, in the best light, how to tie a weaver's knot. It was exactly what Liddy remembered doing, but she knew, to her shame, that her own face had betrayed exasperation, while Bridget's was as gentle as that of a ewe nuzzling her lamb. She smiled ruefully at Bridget as the girl returned to her own looms. Bridget smiled back broadly.
"She's a bit slow, that one. We're all allowed to be fools the first week or two," she said, hearing Diana's voice in her head.
There had been a short note from Diana telling her not to worry, that she had found a place in a seamstress's shop. But how could she not be anxious for her? Bridget was continuing sadly.
"But I'm a fool yet."
She nodded at the psalm pasted on Liddy's loom.
"And you, such a scholar."
Liddy slid her fingers under the paper to loosen the paste and handed it to Bridget.
"Here," she said, "for practice. I'll make another for myself."
Bridget shook her head.
"It will do me no good. I might as well be blind, you know."
But I sent you a note once. I took it straight away to Diana to read to me.
You've learned your letters, at least.
Shamefaced, the girl shook her head. Liddy sighed. She couldn't take Bridget on to teach, but how could she begrudge her a chance to start? She made papers for the girl to post.
A is for agent.
Beside it was a crude picture of a man in a beaver hat, the stern high priest of those invisible Boston gods who had created the corporations and to whom all in Lowell daily sacrificed their lives.
B is for Bobbin, and Bridget, too.
B was instantly mastered.
C is for carding. D is for drawing in.
She went on, using as far as possible words Bridget knew from factory life. Each day, Liddy gave her 3 new papers to post and learn, and, at the end of the day, to take home and practice. So it was that, day by day, without intending to be, Liddy found herself, bound letter by letter, word by word, sentence by sentence, page by page, until it was, "Come by when you've had your supper and we'll work on the reader together." Or on a Sunday afternoon,
"Meet me by the river and I'll bring paper and pens for practice."
She did not go to Bridget's house. She was not afraid to go into the acre. She was not frightened by rumors of robberies and assaults. But somehow, she was reluctant to go for Bridget's sake. She did not want Bridget to have to be ashamed of the only home she had. At last, a letter came from Charlie. She had not allowed herself to look for one, but when it came, she realized how she had longed to hear, just to be reminded that she had not been altogether forgotten.
"Dear Sister Liddy,"
Charlie did make his letters well,
"we are fine. We hope you are well, too. Rachel began school last month. Her cough is nearly